Good evening. It's my pleasure to introduce you to you Shamus Nandri. Shamus is a poet in the great city of Edmonton, which some of us consider the center of the world. Slightly off-center, I guess. He has published a number of volumes of poetry. My sense is that he stands in and writes out of that extraordinary mystical tradition of Islam, Sufism. Shamus studied education initially at the University of London, and then did a graduate degree in the Islamic Center. Come on in.
Sorry.
This may not be where you want to be, but I would highly recommend it. Shamus did an MA in Islamic philosophy at McGill, at the wonderful Islamic Studies Institute at McGill. So I'm delighted you're here this evening with us, and you are going to speak to us about spirituality and poetry, about his own personal search. I really wanted you to be with us on our last night together here, because the work we've been doing together on Islam and modernity and given the nature of global politics and what have you, is a matter of some difficulty and struggle at times. And since I actually believe that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of mankind, I wanted you to talk things out for us. So I'm delighted you're here. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, David. I'm sure you meant humankind rather than mankind, but we'll excuse him that. You know, a couple of weeks ago, there was a really interesting little story at home. My nephew comes to me and says, "Uncle, can I have a chat?" "Sure." Him and I get along very well. Of course, he gets along with his mom and dad, but he gets along with me very well, and I'm the third person to come to if there's trouble. So, sure. So we went to my library and told me, "Uncle, I need to change my name." I said, "What?" I said, "Have you talked to your dad about this?" He said, "Yeah, but he doesn't listen." "Your mom? She's with my dad." "Well, so what's wrong with your name, David?" "You know, the name is David. You have a problem with it? It's an Old Testament name. It has all lovely resonances." He said, "Don't tell me all that, Uncle. I've heard it often from my mom and dad. Often and often. You don't have to keep telling me that." I said, "Okay. So I guess you got a name that you want." He said, "Yeah, I want a high-tech name." "And what would that be?" "DVD." I don't know what to tell him, except, you know, probably in a decade or so, that one would be completely out of fashion. But anyway, it's nice to be here tonight. Thank you very much for the invite, David. I believe I've been to this classroom before about a month ago when three other people gave a talk, or their talk, right? My talk is entitled Spirituality in Poetry: Personal Searches of Muslims, Past, Present, and Future. And I'm sure you don't want to take any notes, because this is the last class, and you're not going to be examined on this, and there's plenty of handouts, okay? I want to emphasize the plural of searches and Muslims. Just like I hope you discover the plurality of the course title, Christianities, Islams, Modernities, Nostalgia for Absolutes, and Dreams of Freedom. So let's begin with a poem. Listen to these oft-quoted verses from the 13th century. "My heart can take on any form, a meadow for gazelles, a cloister for monks, for the idols, sacred ground, Kaaba for the serpent pilgrims, the tablets of the Torah, the scrolls of the Quran. I profess the religion of love. Wherever its caravan turns along the way, that is the belief, the faith I keep." Also from the same writer, "The movement, which is the existence of the universe, is a movement of love." When I first came across these lines, I wondered what kind of world we would be living in if 4 centuries later Isaac Newton had also concluded that love was the cause of the apple that fell on his head. What would Newton's three laws of motion look like if gravity was replaced by love? The verses are from Ibn Arabi, who was born in 1165 in southern Andalusia, now called Spain. At 35, he traveled across North Africa towards Mecca, to Anatolia, now Turkey, to finally settle in Damascus. Honored as the greatest master, a Sheikh al-Akbar, Ibn Arabi was a prolific writer. His Bezels of Wisdom and his multi-volume Meccan Revelations are the best-known work today. As a footnote here, Ibn Arabi may have run into the Crusaders, who were in the Eastern Mediterranean. In addition, the Mongol cavalry was coming in rapidly from the east. Listen now to Jalaluddin Rumi, also from the 13th century. "Why think thus, O men of piety? I have returned to sobriety. I am neither a Muslim nor a Hindu. I am not a Christian, Zoroastrian, or Jew. I am neither of the west nor of the east, nor of the ocean nor earthly beast. I am neither a natural wonder nor from the stars yonder. My place is no place, my image without face. Neither of body nor the soul, I am of the divine whole. I eliminated duality with joyous laughter, so the unity of here and hereafter. Unity is what I seek, unity is what I sing, unity is what I speak, unity is what I know, unity is what I seek." Rumi is one of the several poets looming large in Iranian and Turkish traditions, as well as in the subcontinent and North American traditions. His appeal is universal. I typed Rumi in an internet search engine and saw 4.5 million entries in several languages. Mm-hmm. I'm heartened when I see poems by Rumi and books on Rumi in major stores across Canada, not only in the poetry section, but as well as in the Islam section, which is often destitute of good literature. Mm-hmm. It's a small step in a long journey to ameliorate the knowledge deficit that plagues North American culture and the education of its young. This course is another small step. A large part of his appeal is due to the accessibility of his work, compared, for instance, to Ibn Arabi, who is recondite and tends to be esoteric. Rumi wrote primarily in verse, Ibn Arabi primarily in prose. Rumi is part of a poetic tradition, Ibn Arabi a philosophical tradition. Rumi is referred to as ecstatic, Ibn Arabi as sober. Certainly there is some truth to this label. They are often used rather loosely in the Orientalist tradition, the academic vector of colonialism, and I'd like to avoid this essentialism tonight. Rumi was born in 1207 in Balkh, Afghanistan. His family moved westwards ahead of the Mongol cavalry to finally settle in Konya, Turkey. The Mevlevi order, famous for its whirling dervishes, you all see those? Also called Rogarians. To finally settle in Konya, Turkey. The Mevlevi order, famous for its whirling dervishes, takes him as its founder. Jalaluddin Rumi led a staid life teaching law and theology until 1244. He was 37 when a mysterious figure called Shams Tabriz appeared in his life and 4 years later vanished. Rumi, however, was utterly transformed. His famous poem, 26,000 verses in length, called the Mahdavi, begins with a complaint of a flute. "Ever since that time that I was torn away from the reed bed, my cries have caused men and women many a sigh to shed. I want a chest that has been ripped apart, wide apart by separation, so that of the deepest longing I can give an explanation." The Mahdavi is often affectionately known as the Quran in Farsi. Another work, his Divan, is dedicated to Shams Tabriz, who changed his life. Listen now to someone from the 11th century. "I began to search for guidance of the chosen one of God, but when I asked around for reasons regarding the injunctions of religion or the verse of the Quran on which they are based, none proved to be helpful. One resembled the blind, the other deaf. And so I rose from my place and started on a journey, abandoning without regret my house, my garden, and those I was accustomed to see. From Persian and Arab, Indian and Turk, from the inhabitants of Sindh, Byzantium, from everyone else, from philosophers, Manichaeans, Sabaeans, atheists, did I inquire as to what interested me with much persistence." This is Nasir Khusro, also born in Balkh, Afghanistan, 200 years prior to Rumi, soon after Y1K. Since there were no computers around then, people didn't face the anxiety of synchronized clocks and calendars rebooting and causing chaos. But then, time was not homogenized either. Nasir Khusro lived his life by another calendar, where the year zero is the hijra of the Prophet from Mecca to Medina, peace be upon him. Khusro's personal search, illustrated in the poem, precipitated a dream when he was about 40. He took off westward from Mecca and the Fatimid court in Cairo. He lived there for 3 years. After meeting the Imam, he finally went back home. Khusraw writes as a poet and as a philosopher. His book of travels, translated in 30 languages, his Divan, his Confluence of Two Wisdoms, are his best known works. The high esteem he held is illustrated in the following story. It is still Soviet times. Tajikistan is still a Soviet republic. So an officer comes from Moscow to make an inspection, and he's shown around the schools and the hospitals and the factories and all that, all these things that display progress. And he's also pointed out that there are, you know, the high mountain peaks like Mount Lenin, Mount Communism, Mount 5th of May. The fellow of Moscow, from Moscow, he, of course, you know, he's learned about the customs and he's sensitive to them. So he asked a question. He says, "Aren't you a bit worried or aren't you upset that there is no Mount Nasir Khusraw?" So the Tajik host looked at him and said, "There is no mountain high enough." So, we could easily spend the rest of the evening discussing Nasir Khusraw, Jalaluddin Rumi, or Ibn Arabi, and I will return to them. I started my talk with them for the following reasons. They are towering figures of in the spiritual tradition, and believe me, there are quite a few others. Their lives are distinct from lives lived in scripturalist traditions. Their acceptance of the reality of human diversity is representative of spirituality in all civilizations. The search for truth has more validity than the possession of the truth. What a difference from the virulent absolutes, both religious and secular, screaming around us. Nasir Khusraw, Jalaluddin Rumi, and Ibn Arabi are alive in contemporary spiritual traditions and not things found in old books and museums. As people around the world recover from 5 centuries of colonization, they are uncovering their own past and are rejuvenated by the spirituality these three embody. Their use of vertical language is the imaginative space to which we will travel this evening. So what I'd like you to do this evening is to acquaint you with some figures, some vocabulary of this space. A space in which these individuals have journeyed and about which they have written, using language we can relate to. Let us call on someone from the 12th century to guide us through this space where vertical language operates. His name is Aynel Khuda Hamadani. In a treatise called The Best of Realities, note the plural, he makes 2 points that are important for us tonight. The first is about proximity. There are 3 kinds of proximity: spatial, intellectual, and spiritual. The first two are easy to understand, perhaps obvious. We are in spatial proximity to each other in this room. We are not in spatial proximity to people in Vancouver, Ottawa, or Nunavut. Secondly, intellectually we are on the same wavelength. At least I hope we are. We may be the proverbial birds of a feather. We may also be like-minded with some people in Vancouver, Ottawa, or Nunavut, or we may not. We may not be like-minded in this room. Aynel Khuda refers to this as intellectual proximity. 2 people may be in spatial proximity, but intellectually distant. 2 other people may be in intellectual proximity, but spatially distant. The third proximity can only be spoken about in terms of the first two, hence the ambiguity of language, or what I refer to as verticality. This is Aynel Khuda's 2nd point relevant for us tonight. Just as there is a qualitative leap from spatial to intellectual proximity, there is also a qualitative leap from intellectual to spiritual proximity. It's like the difference between mathematics and grace. It's like a blind person's hand trying to be an eye. Yes, there are instances when it will get by, but a hand cannot replace an eye. Neither can an ear or a nose, for that matter. Of course, Aynel Khuda didn't know about Jody LaForge, the Star Trek engineer fitted with a visor, but you get the idea. Aynel Khuda uses the expression "face of God," of which there are several occurrences in the Quran to explain the idea. One instance in the Quran is, "To Allah belong the east and the west, and wherever you turn, there is a face of Allah." Aynel Khuda writes, "All things are contiguous in this proximity. In the face of God, there is simultaneity. Everything is present to God," he writes, "but God is present with everything." Apparently, space, time, and hierarchy as we know them have no reference in this proximity. Love is the operating system of this proximity, just as senses and logic are the operating systems of the first 2 proximities. Of course, as in other areas of human endeavor, this is tested and experienced. Aynel Khuda is writing from his own experiences in a laboratory that is his own self, a self he pushed to the limits. The theory of proximity is a small part of his corpus that questions the prevailing impersonal narratives of theology, law, of philosophy, of mysticism. But power never liked to be questioned. He was murdered by the state at 1131 at the young age of 33. To the two points made by Anil Khuda, I would like to add a third. I came across him after having studied developmental psychology. Names like Piaget, Bruner, and Kagan became part of my vocabulary. I saw his theory of proximities as another model of human development, with one critical difference. Piaget, Bruner, etc. are limited to the first two proximities, spatial and intellectual. Their work is primarily in the cognitive field. They do not consider what Anil Khuda calls spiritual proximity. There is a reason for this, no pun intended. It's called the Enlightenment. Not in the sense that Ibn Arabi, Rumi, Nasir Khusro, and Anil Khuda use it, but in the sense given to it in Europe after his battle with the church. Reason one, Christianity had to go. I guess the baby got thrown out with the bathwater. Doors to spirituality were banged shut, and intellectual proximity, militantly wedded to spatial proximity, has reigned supreme. Hence the nostalgia for absolutes in what is called the West, as well as in the rest. The most common absolute is a nation state with its monopoly of law and of violence, perhaps the most horizontalizing language available. Compare this to the vertical language we are discussing this evening. Here is an instance of vertical language, with most of you are familiar. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. This is Jesus, peace be upon him. Here are two examples you may not know. I was a prophet when Adam was between water and clay. This is Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Allah is the light of the heavens and the earth. The parable of his light is as if there were a niche and within it a lamp. The lamp enclosing glass, the glass like a brilliant star. Lit from a blessed tree, an olive, neither of the east nor of the west, whose oil is well nigh luminous, though fire barely touches it. Light upon light. Allah guides whom He wills to His light. Allah strikes parables for people. Allah knows all things. This is the single most commented on verse in the Quran. The Quran and the Prophet are, of course, central to the personal searches of Muslims, past, present, and perhaps future. In the life of the Prophet, there are two special events that link into a time out of time. One is the beginning of the revelation. It's an evening in the cave in Mount Hira outside Mecca. The Prophet has been there seeking solitude and answers to existential questions. He is about 40. This evening a voice calls out to him to recite, to read, or to invoke. Recite in the name of your Lord who creates humans out of a cloth. Recite, your Lord is most bountiful, who teaches by the pen, who teaches humans what they know not. This is Surah Iqra. The story of the Prophet's first revelation inhabits the same space among Muslims as the story of Jesus' birth does for Christians. It's called Laylatul Qadr. Laylatul Qadr and Christmas are beginnings, earth-transforming events, as well as heart-transforming events. Like Christmas, Laylatul Qadr is commemorated annually. The other event in the Prophet's life is called Isra wa Mi'raj, or the night journey and ascension. Archangel Gabriel awakens the Prophet, sits him on a winged horse called Burak, or lightning, and takes him to Jerusalem. Here he prays with Jesus, Moses, and Abraham. After meeting with other prophets, previous prophets, he finds himself in the presence of the divine. A hadith, or a saying of the Prophet says, I have a time with God, where even Gabriel has no access. These two events, the revelation and the ascension, are foundational for Muslim spiritual traditions. The wish for unity, the total loss of self in something infinitely larger, this existential search for that primordial time out of time is what drives many, many Muslims in their personal searches. Sufi is one generic term for such individuals who are not satisfied with the rituals and with the scriptures. Take Rabi al-Basri, for instance. We were just discussing her in the car on the way here. I love you with two loves, a selfish love and a love of which you are worthy. That love, which is a selfish love, is my remembrance of you and nothing else. But as for love of which you are worthy, would that I see no more creatures but see you. There is no praise for me in either love, but praise is yours in this love and in that. There's a lovely story about Rabia. It's a late 19th century Basra. She's walking home with a pail of water in one hand and a firebrand in the other. Of course, people ask her, what on earth are you doing? She replies, waters for the fires of hell, quenched so nothing's to tell. The fear that keeps you good is long gone. Understood? In heaven we'll face this torch. There's so much there to scorch. Wishing for the celestial bliss. Gone to ashes. Blow it a kiss. Now you know what I'm doing. Think only of the all-knowing. Point your face in that direction. It's the only pole for salvation. That's Rabia for you. Apparently a slave who was freed by her owner because he saw a halo on her head when she was praying. Now, of course, he feared for his own safety. Little is known about her. Nonetheless, Rabia is revered in many Sufi traditions that elevate her exclusive love for the divine to an archetype. 3 centuries later, Ibn Arabi can write, she was the most famous interpreter of love. Both poem and story are from biographical dictionaries of the 10th and 11th centuries. A biographical dictionary is like a who's who. Of course, like many documents recounting the past, they are his stories, i.e. stories of males. But the passive acceptance of this generalization can be misleading. Recent findings by Muhammad Akram Nadwi of Oxford and Lucknow are illuminating. He has rediscovered a tradition of Muslim women teaching the Quran, transmitting prophetic traditions and making law. When I first came across it, I said, what's so surprising? Women make the law, don't they? When Akram began his search of female scholars 10 years ago, he thought he'd find maybe 20 or 30 instances. To date, he has found 8,000. His biographical dictionary spans 40 volumes. Let us now hear from Abu Yazid Bistami, who was born around the same time Rabia shuffled off her mortal coil. There's a little ditty about him. Asking his disciples to take heed, there's a little story of Abu Yazid. Stand your guard on the lip of hell. Make sure its numbers don't swell. Each approaching soul accord respect, and to heaven straightway direct. All doubts in your heart do quell, and take yourself instead to hell. And here's a story. Abu Yazid stops up in the city where he buys some saffron seeds. He puts them in his pocket and brings them home. And when he gets home, he discovers that when he takes the seeds out, there's an ant in there. And he says, oh, I displaced a poor creature from his home. So he returns to the city and puts the ant gently back in the same place that he found it. Told tales of a well-respected Sufi from way back then. Maybe they're apocryphal. The ethical message they carry makes them valuable. Kindness for life, no matter how small. Doing good for others, even at the expense of oneself. As a general rule, the lovers of the divine did not advocate withdrawal from daily life. Concern for fellow humans was important. Here's a paradox from the same guy. Abu Yazid meets another Sufi who says to him, I have drunk from the cup of the divine and I am full. Abu Yazid retorts, I have drunk the 7 seeds and I am still thirsty. This story, with its never-ending search, belongs to Ayn al-Qudha's spiritual proximity. Like this instance where the prophet is quoting the divine, heaven and earth contain me not, yet the heart of my faithful servant does. Here's another lover of the divine, Shams Tabrawari from the 12th century. He was also part of a living spiritual tradition. He is reputed to have gone from his birthplace in Iran to India, where he became part of a much larger Bhakti movement that spanned all manner of religious, linguistic, and cultural divides. He writes, now, by your love, I am struck. My heart, by your love, is struck. Let your eyes with mine have truck. My Lord, by your love, I am struck. Remove the veil, look on me with grace. Smile, smile, show me your face. My Lord, by your love I am struck. For your vision, your Shams is thirsty. Let me see you bestow this charity. There are many others, like Rabia, Abu Yazid, Shams, that can be added to Ibn Arabi, Rumi, Nasir Khusro, Ayn al-Qudha. There is Abu Hamid Ghazali of the 11th and 12th centuries, a prolific writer, whose very public spiritual crisis while he was a teacher in Baghdad's famous law school is well recorded. There is Surawali al-Maktul of 12th century Syria, to whom Aristotle appeared in a dream, directing his path. His well-known philosophy of illumination conceives of all existence in terms of light, quite different from his composition in terms of 112 elements of the periodic table. Lala Ded or Lala Rifa of the 14th century, whose verses are on the lips of most Kashmiris, whether they be Hindu or Muslim. There are other individuals who have become stuff of legends, like Baba Tukles, who in the 14th century converted to Islam one of the Mongol conquerors, Uzbek Khan, from where we get the name Uzbekistan. There are hundreds of stories about Mulla Nasruddin, an imaginative locus of morals as well as humans. His stories remind me of the coyote in Aboriginal stories. Again, I could go on, but let's fast forward to the present. There are extracts from 11 different pieces of music. There are about 1.5 million each. I've edited some songs as their preludes are quite lengthy. The lyrics will be projected on the screen with the song. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pieces are from a constellation of singers and genres. Remember, there are spiritual music traditions around the world. My selections are, of course, personal and arbitrary. However, there is a method in the madness. You must have noticed the repetition, the refrains, whether this be Allahu Akbar, Ya Mustafa, or Ali. The constant repetition of any one of the divine names of God, the name of the Prophet, or the name of the first Imam is called fikr. Dhikr is most commonly translated as remembrance. The word occurs often in the Quran. For instance, Allah is glorified in the mornings and in the evenings by people whom neither trade nor merchandise can divert from remembrance of Allah. And a quote from the Prophet, "For everything there is a polish, and the polish of the heart is the remembrance of God." Dhikr is called a polish of the heart. It's part of the practice of meditation. You heard examples of dhikr in music. Dhikr can be practiced alone or in congregation, in silence or out loud, with or without music, standing or dancing, sitting or sleeping. The regular practice of dhikr is, of course, a great stress reliever. Important though this is, this polish of the heart is far more than just that. It gives each person a chance to slow down, to disconnect from the world, from being caught up with the material aspects of life. Like in Rumi's poem, we don't really own anything. So what is this competition we feel when we're all going out through the same gate, one by one? Dhikr leads to a second rubric that I will illustrate with a poem. We know the moth circle of flame. Well, here is Faridin Attar's version. Burning with desire, the moths gather knowledge of fire, a future treasure. One ventures out and espies flame, then turns about to claim her fame. You merely saw it, your claim's false, you don't know it, need someone else. Second goes near, close to the burn, hot like severe, thinks of return. Wing tip to flame, Prometheus not, so back she came, no brand cost. You did better, did go to the edge, still stays chatter, it's not knowledge. Now is the third, her turn has come, knows the hazard, flies at chasm. Dives into the fire, no second thought, was her one desire, all she ever sought. From a distance, those watching see a brilliance, a disappearing. She stays at flame, we're no better off. Count her and reclaim, that's the trade-off. There's a wonderful rejoinder I read from another Sufi. Mort says to fire, I gave you my life. Fire retorts, I allowed you to kiss me. The story of the moth is one of several in the 12th century poet Faruddin Akhtar's Conference of the Birds. The central plot is a group of birds who gather in search of their king. Many with excuses do not start out. Others fall by the wayside. After an arduous journey, the sturdy birds arrive at their destination. They are led into a huge hall where they discover that what they are searching for is themselves. The story of the birds is an allegory of the human soul's journey. The story of the moth is also symbolic of the capacity of an individual to find oneself in something larger. The extinction of oneself in the larger is referred to as fana in the spiritual traditions of Islam. Fana is shorthand for fana fi Allah, or extinction in God. Death before dying is another term. Ibn Arabi calls it voluntary death. He writes, now since we know that our meeting with God can only be brought about through death, and because we knew the inner meaning of death, we sought to bring it about sooner in the life of this world. Hence we died in the very source of our life to all our concerns and activities and desires, so that when death overcame us in the midst of that life, which never passes from us, we met God and He met us. He calls the body a veil that has been removed, and goes on to quote Imam Ali, the first Imam, even if the veil were removed, I would not be any more certain. After the voluntary death, one arrives at Baqa, shorthand for Baqa bi Allah, or dwelling in God. It is the start of a different relationship with the world in which one lives. It is being in this world, but not of this world. Mm-hmm. Listen to Sultan Bahu from the 17th century Indian subcontinent. What do the living know of the dead? Only they know who die. The grave has neither food nor water. One must bring supplies from home, leaving one's mother, father, siblings, and the torments of the grave. How fortunate are they, Bahu, who die while still living. And he goes on, everyone asks for firmness in faith, but few ask for firmness in love. They ask for faith and are ashamed of love. Such arrogant hearts. Faith has no place. Faith has no idea of the place where love transports you. I swear by my faith, Bahu, keep my love firm. And so, religion, politics, biology, society, etc., etc., are all accepted. Attachments, however, are not. It's a vertical orientation or a spiritual proximity. What remains, of course, is the practice. And this requires work. Like Usain Bolt or Donovan Bailey in the physical world, just like Amartya Sen or the iconic Albert Einstein in the intellectual world, it's practice, dedication, commitment to the exclusion of all else, if not all else. That's why these people I'm introducing to you tonight live on in the imagination of millions of Muslims today. The practice of dhikr and the search for voluntary death take an institutional form in what is called tariqa. Tariqa translates as path or way. When I quoted Jesus earlier, I am the way, the truth, and the life, this is the same idea. Each tariqa is the way, the truth, and the life. It is this motivation, this practice, this calling that takes institutional form. The three people with whom I began my talk, Jalaluddin Rumi is a founder of the Mevlevi Tariqa. Ibn Arabi is not a founder, nor is he associated with any Tariqa. Nasir Khusro is part of the Shia Tariqa, of which there are several, all of whom take Imam Ali as their founder. So parted from their mortal coils, all three are alive and well, still nurturing new searches, still impelling explorations past silence. Jesus too is revered. You must remember that the Quran speaks highly of both Mary and Jesus, and so do Muslims. The difference between the history of demonization of the Prophet in Christendom and in the West on the one hand, And the respect according to Jesus, also a prophet among Muslims on the other end, is like the difference between night and day. There's a book by Tariq Khalili called The Muslim Jesus. It's in the handouts. Take a look at it. Khalili calls it Collections of Stories About Jesus, the Fifth Gospel after Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. Between the lines is the idea that Christians do not have a copyright on Jesus. Junayd al-Baghdadi in the 9th century, for instance, is credited with the aphorism, Sufism is founded on 8 qualities, founded in 8 prophets. The 8 prophets are Abraham, Ismail, Moses, John, Job, Zechariah, Jesus, and Muhammad. Peace be upon them all. Each one has a story. Jesus, for instance, was so detached from worldly things that he kept only a cup and a comb. The cup he gave away when he saw a man drinking with the palms of his own hands, and likewise the comb when he saw another man using his fingers instead of a comb. Muhammad was so poor that Allah sent the key of all the treasures that are upon the earth, saying, "Lay no trouble on yourself, but procure every luxury by means of these treasures." He answered, "O Lord, I desire them not. Keep me instead one day full fed and one day hungry." And Junaid's story is far from being the only one. In this story, Junaid is referring to a sacred history, a hero history. This is what a tariqa signifies. Time, as we normally understand it, does not have the same meaning. When you hear once upon a time, or ceremonial time, mystic time, these convey some idea of what I'm saying by tariqa time. A tariqa is an institution, and it does not have to be a building, that brings together what I've said to you. It allows, indeed fosters, spiritual proximity. Just as one suspends belief when one is honestly practicing philosophy or science and works with an advisor, or suspends disbelief and trusts in one's innermost self and a guide or a teacher. To go back to Anil Qudsavalli, writes, "Prior to experiencing spiritual proximity, I believed in it like a blind man believes in colors. A blind person cannot see, distinguish between light and darkness, never mind see colors. His belief was based on what he had learned from another teacher, another master." Remember, I'm not talking about suspending your faculty of reason or your ability to think rationally. Just as one moves from the spiritual to the intellectual, just as one can think in the abstract instead of having to touch and feel like a child, this is another qualitative leap. One has to work at it, dedicate oneself to it. Take the example of this university, where it requires years of sustained work to get a doctorate. A tariqa is also an institution where you are mentored, taught, and you yourself are the laboratory. I mean you and self. Two words. The self is a site of experimentation, the site of analysis, the locus of growth. A teacher or teachers are involved. They are mentors, guides, because they have been where you are going. Some of these mentors have been introduced to you this evening. Of course, there are many others, and it's up to you to find out more. There are handouts, bibliographies. Many of you must be familiar with the Enigma Music Project. There's a great piece called TNT for the Brain. Use these handouts as TNT for your brain. And so to conclude, this evening I have introduced to you a handful of Muslims in multiple spiritual traditions. People are referred to as exponents of vertical language. What distinguishes them is their acceptance of the reality of human diversity, in which the search for truth has more validity than the possession of the truth. Second, I have introduced you to a theory of spatial, intellectual, and spiritual proximities. Third, I hope you have gained some understanding of zikr, or remembrance as a polish of the heart, of fana and baka as extinction and dwelling in God, and of tariqa, or the path, as an institution. Finally, when David asked me to come and speak tonight, he also asked me to give him a 3-line summary. I'll read it out to you. This lecture will endeavor to add to the Canadian imagination, one that has served the land admirably, but now needs to enlarge considerably. As many of the spaces and times unload their meanings and rhymes, here's hoping we'll accept them graciously with heart and not build a rampart. Thank you. Well, I'll be happy to take questions if there are any discussion. Anyone? Maybe you like the music? Any particular ones you like or didn't like? Because I myself, I've grown up in many different worlds, like quote-unquote Eastern, quote-unquote Western Africa and Asia and Europe and North America. So I sometimes cannot relate to what is very traditional Qawwali music, for instance, but when it's played to another beat that I grew up with, like Elvis or Beatles, for instance, that works for me.
Yeah. I thought your interview was Cass Stevens.
No, I was, but I didn't bring it. Okay, does everybody know Yusuf Islam? That's what he's called now? Cass Stevens? Yeah. I met him in London at a lecture, and he said, well, of course, he was asked about how he changed. And he said he was into drugs and everything else. And then his brother, for some coincidental reason, had gone to Lebanon and brought him a copy of the Quran. And he started reading. And he said, that totally changed his life. I asked him, I said, you know, I love your music. What's going to happen to that music? He said, I'm too near to what's just happened for me to write new music. But he said, I will in future. And sure enough, you know, down the road he's come up with a lot of completely different kind of music, but great music. So, you know, different kind of life, different music, but same person, Cat Stevens and Yusuf Islam. So I'm glad you like the music. I could have chosen from hundreds and hundreds of different ones. It was hard, but I specifically chose a few that I wanted to illustrate the idea of zikr or remembrance. Ali is extremely, extremely dear. Just like all other prophets, as I said, Jesus, Abraham, Moses, you know. One reads the Quran, you know, the most often mentioned prophet in the Quran is who? Take a guess. Moses. Hundreds of times. After him comes Abraham, just 100 times. And then a lot of others. Muhammad is mentioned only twice. So,
you brought one of your own books.
Yeah, I just
see it sitting there.
Sure.
Could you give us a taste?
Sure. I'd be happy to. Actually, some of the poems that I read out were actually poems that I'd written, like the one on Rabia or the one on Abu Yazid Bistami. Some of the ones I have, have been translated often before. Let me read two or three. This one is called Ismail and Isaac. Look, here's two lines of young children, one going to Calgary, the other to Edmonton. It's somber, it's quiet, it's not about fun. Many Ismails, many Isaacs, some of them carrying packs with yesterday's school snacks. 300 kilometers each way, a million kids on the highway. Should have been in class or at play. They're all dead, you see. They happen to be Iraqi. With shock and awe, there's no plea. Their parents are in pain. There's a tall one now and again, from the US, young, also slain. Child sacrifice, industrial scale. Others' kids, male and female. No worries, we'll prevail. Whose battle, whose war? Haven't we done all this before? Abraham's land, soaked with gore. But those two lines of young children, many a daughter, many a son. How many more before we're done? You know, this. I'll go to the back and read one. You know, there was a young man, person elected to the Senate in the U.S. by the name of Ralph Ellison. And he, of course, he wanted to swear, and he wanted to swear on the Quran. Of course, it took a lot of people by surprise. But he had a trick up his sleeve. He found a copy of the Quran in the Library of Congress that belonged to Thomas Jefferson, third president. So a lot of people had to take back and say, hey, Jesus, you know, this is part of our tradition. It belongs to the third president. How can we say anything wrong? But nonetheless, imagine a Quran owned by Jefferson appearing in the state all of a sudden. Imagine a new congressman's desire to take an oath the law does require. It's a Quran he'd like to use, another tradition he'd like to choose. There's one in the Library of Congress, you could say it's ageless. It belonged to the third president, and folks can't help but resent. What a shock on the horizon. A glorious past now undone. Like Rushmore come tumbling down because the Quran come into town. All the Muslims getting elected. It's a nightmare straight ahead. Our destiny is under attack. We've got to hit them back. Can't you see we're Christians? We must protect our own bastion. We have a book. It's the Bible. Nothing else is comparable. Why doesn't he use the blessed book? Why does he need another holy book? What's with the U.S. and all this hate? How many targets before it'll have been? Indians, Africans, Japanese, Chinese, and even Muslims who watch this plea. How many echoes of plantations, of Guantanamos, of reservations? It's a book, people, and it is guidance. Hold your hate in abeyance. Like the Testament, please read it first. Dump your phobia, be well versed. With all our power, are we so insecure? In our hearts, are we so poor? If the President owned and took a closer look, why are we so afraid of the other holy books? Abraham and Moses, he must have read. Jesus, Muhammad too, same virtuous thread. All these prophets, the same mission, hence the name, Abrahamic tradition. The Quran is not as alien as it seems. It's in our past, our hopes and dreams. There's a change coming to our identity. The U.S. will be a newer entity. Ellison's paying respect to the Constitution. We the people, its very foundation. Forget the race, look at the principle. Yes, it's possible. Aren't we all people? What alternative do we have if we don't humanely behave? As one of your goals, we have become fire. A fire listens to its creator. You all know the story about Abraham and the fire, right? Yes, no?
Tell
us. Okay. I'm not sure that it's in the Old Testament, but it's well recited in the Quran in a number of places. Abraham grows up in a community who worship idols. So he protests, talks to his father, talks to his people, nobody listens. And of course, this is recounted in the Quran by, you know, there's a divine intercession every now and again, which the God tells him what to do. So finally, one day, he decides to do something rather than talk. He goes to the place where all the idols are, takes up a hammer, and he smashes every one of them except the biggest one. And of course, he gets caught very quickly. And the people ask, he says, you know, who did this? And he points to the big idol and says, he did it. And say, what? He can't do anything. He said, he can't do anything and you worship him or it. So it's a great play. It's a wonderful story. It's very educational, but of course, the education in this sense had a negative impact because they threw him into the fire. And what happened, of course, is the miracle, yeah? That they put him in the fire and they expected the fire to burn Abraham, but Abraham survived. So that's the story in the Quran, because God asked the fire to be cool. When I wrote this book, it was the year 2000, and the Laylat al-Qadr, that's the night of Revelation, and Christmas were 5 days apart. And for some reason, this spoke to me. So I went back to reading the Old Testament, I went back to reading the Quran multiple times, and I started off with the story of Jesus and Mary. So I was intrigued, and what would I write about it? Instead, I was led to Abraham. Of course, it was winter, it was dark, and fire, as David very well put it when we were coming down up, it is warm and has lots of light, so that's what attracted me. So I started reading about Abraham over and over again, and that's what led to this book, actually, many years later. So we have become fire. The fire listens to its creator. Another is out of control. The first is peaceful, the other our future soul. The first is deemed untrue and abnormality. The other happens to be this war-torn reality. Tradition has been mythologized. This tradition is also weaponized. With humans taking the center, we now soar into entry. And yet we remain Neanderthal, with little space for reason recall. But here is Abraham facing our tradition, our earthly penchant for nuclear ammunition. He questions our weaponized space, our fissile culture, with no saving grace. Compares his kind of modernity with our armed insanity. Remembers the idols he dispatched, and their profiles he then mashed. They sure were dumb, blind and deaf too. How could there be a source of value? Myth this way may well be, but his ancient profile perfectly matches our atomic pile. Numerous they are in silos on the ground, waiting to annihilate all sight and sound. With all gods banished or dead, we place our faith in these instead. Gone missing is intelligence. Also MIA is common sense. Not surprisingly, weaponized space matches our impaired mental space. The very thought of change seems a little strange, though the Earth's killing rate is rising faster than the Earth's intel estimates. Here is Abraham again in the fire space, the flames him closely embrace. But being a friend, his protector's ace, Abraham, not burnt, lives on by grace. Take him now to be the monotheist community, even better yet, all of humanity. Why have we made Abraham our enemy? We become gods. Isn't this called epidemic? We become fire, destroyer of the world. Our future will be a nether world. There is no God to appeal to, no intelligence to fall back to. We become dumb, blind and deaf too, now that we are our own source of value. Having achieved such stature, we are now our own final dispatcher. Gods and idols, we are these two. Roaches, I guess, will begin anew. Okay, all right. All right. There's another one. I try and write sometimes a little funny verses. Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't, but nonetheless. When their nemesis didn't burn, what was their one primary concern to the old world, how to return? When the heat didn't make manifest, were their thumbs totally stressed, and were others in cardiac arrest? In the coolness, did their stomachs tighten? When the flames failed, did their ire heighten? Why was there no burning for Abraham, this titan? Daily the women cooked their food, their flames were always pretty good. Why today was the law so skewed? Was this Abraham some kind of technician? How could he destroy so much tradition, and with their gods with holy ignition? Did their fury rise in proportion to see the world in such consortium? Who said how the blame to now apportion? The rage of the audience, was it evenly distributed? Were the rebels who were there delighted? Was this with this modernity and much excited? On them did the others vent their frustration? No doubt they were full of accusations. Who are they adding to this aberration? But then maybe it just poured on that one spot. The sun followed, shining so hot. And Abraham was gone, like a shot. But this would be unconvincing, quite contrary to a truth telling, and avoidance of the book compelling.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Lovely to hear you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here, I must say. I hope you enjoy the music and what I said. I hope, like they use these handouts, there's a lot of reading. I know you get a lot of reading, but you know, you're in university. I tell you, I began my reading long after I left. So maybe the same thing will happen to you too, but right now I read voraciously. And it's long after I left the university. I read a little, because I mean, you have access to libraries, like electronic libraries. It's just, I mean, technology has its problems, but as far as libraries are concerned, as far as inter-loan libraries are concerned, as far as electronic libraries are concerned, whew, I thank God.
We have a little bit to eat and drink here. You're welcome to stay and talk a little bit more with Thomas Nanji. I want to say, I'm sure on behalf of my colleagues, that it's been a real pleasure for us to have each of you with us this term, and also for the various men and women from the larger community. It's always such a pleasure to be able to see the dance. So thanks so much. Lovely to see you.